Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for the organizers to the opportunity to participate in the workshop, and I look forward to your feedback on our recent results. So today I would like to discuss theory of cell type specialization, and in particular we have been thinking about this problem in the context of two questions. One is, when does it become optimal to split neuronal population into two or more subgroups? And that's where I will devote most of my time during this talk today. And the second question, which I think could potentially be very relevant to neurogenesis in olfactory circuit, and it addresses how can we modulate the network gain by the presence of hyperexcitable minority neurons. And I don't think I will have time to talk about it, the second part, but I will just briefly, as a one sentence, summarize the results. And if anybody is interested, I'm happy to talk about the results this week. But mainly the answer is that we can characterize the dynamics of the network, of a recurrent network, in terms of its eigenvalues or modes, and depending on the size of these eigenvalue spectrum, the network can be either in a chaotic regime or in a stable regime. And one can make the network transition between the regime by introducing a small fraction of hyperexcitable neurons. So that's all I'm going to say about part two. And then part one is, when does it become optimal to split neuronal population? So the idea is that suppose you have a small organism with a small number of neurons, and what I will argue is that initially you will start with a population of neurons that have the same properties and you just average over them. And then as neurons become more reliable, it becomes optimal to allocate them slightly different function. So most of the theory of definition of cell types is canonically based on what kind of features these neurons encode. But that's not the question I'm addressing today. Today will be a different kind of question. What happens when you have multiple cell types that are devoted to encoding the same feature but maybe at different thresholds? So we can think about it as it's a general model. I have a signal. It can be an olfactory signal or it can be a visual signal. And we will have a detector. And every time the signal crosses the detection threshold, a neuron will produce a spike. And then, of course, there is some variability in where that threshold is set. So if we were to repeat the same sensory stimulus multiple times, we will have some variability in the neural response. For example, here there will be a spike, and then on the second run there might not be a spike. So the question is, given metabolic cost, when, where, and a certain, which includes the amount of precision in the level of noise in this threshold device, so where would it be optimal to place that threshold? And we can evaluate the quality of this, how well does this neuron encode the incoming sensory signal by a number of measures. One of them is information, mutual information transmitted, but that's not the only measure. And actually, a number of different measures give similar results. So that's one setup. But then the question is, suppose I have now two neurons. So they have, each neuron has its own noise level. And the question is whether it's optimal to have these neurons have the same threshold or different threshold. If they have the same threshold, then technically it will be same type of neurons, and we will just average over the results. And if they have the different thresholds, and the difference in thresholds is noticeable outside of their noise levels, then they would represent two different kinds of cell types. And often, at least in auditory modality and in visual modality, we have different cell types. For example, low gain neuron and a high gain neuron. And I'm not sure, perhaps in olfaction is something like that. So a theoretical model, at first, is very simple. I consider two neurons. That's a theorist model of neural population. And it has four parameters, two thresholds for two neurons, and the two noise levels for also two neurons. So a total of four parameters. But we will evaluate these solutions, compare solutions that have the same metabolic cost, meaning that generally if you have different metabolic resources available, generally you will be able to do transmit information more. But the question is, given the same metabolic cost, which solution is better? So what do I mean by the metabolic cost? Out of these four parameters, the parameters that are related to the metabolic cost is the noise level for individual neurons. So we will separately consider solutions for different noise levels for individual neurons. And then it turns out that the average between these thresholds roughly relates to how many spikes these two neurons will produce. So the average threshold between neuron also between the two neurons also is a constraint parameter. So in reality, out of the four parameters, in order to find maximally informative solution for a given metabolic cost, we only have one parameter, which is the difference in threshold between neurons. So it's a very simple theoretical problem. Yes.
So the noise is the width of the distribution of the thresholds, but the threshold is fixed for any given neuron, or it varies.
So I measure everything in terms of, so you can think of the signal, so the signal has some variance.
Okay, so it's the
we measure, I measure everything in units of that variance. Then at the end, if you're interested, we can talk about more naturalistic stimuli, meaning that the variance of the input distribution will not be a Gaussian, but will be, for example, a more sparsely distributed signal, as in olfactory plumes. But it turns out the results qualitatively do not change. Quantitatively, they do change, depending on the shape of the distribution. So in principle, the model is you have, say, for example, a Gaussian white noise of a given variance. I will measure the noise level of the two neurons in units of, everything is measured in units of that standard deviation. Yes?
And your binning, or is this just the representation there, or are you taking proteins times, you know, what is the, I mean?
So I will bin.
So that's the fifth parameter, I guess.
No, not really at this parameter. I don't view it as a fifth parameter because, so in reality, what happens is you have a continuous signal and the neuron will have, I took out that slide, but so you have, this is the signal. It's being filtered by a neural temporal feature. So after that, you get a filtered signal. And then that's the signal that may be smoother, and that's the signal that I will bin.
And your bin width is always small enough so that there's always a zero or a one, never
yeah.
a two?
So it is, most of the results are for binary model. I think the results can be, there was work by Brunel and Nadal which showed the mapping between
Fisher and Mutual.
Oh, yeah, but also between a binary lots of binary neurons and one non-binary neuron. So if you have many binary neurons with different thresholds, then that can be a model for smoothly tuned firing neuron. So in principle, one could view it as either, you know, a neuron that each neuron represents a population of different.
One last question about the setup. So the two neurons are getting the same signal input. Are they actually also getting the exact same noise, or is the noise independent?
So right now, I'm for the in the beginning, I'm going to assume that the noise is independent. Then we can talk about how to generalize. If the noise is correlated, then we can talk about the generalization. I think it
so the noise is added by each neuron effectively is the idea.
Yeah, so and then it basically, if the noise is correlated, then when we compare it to data, then there will be a mismatch between I will need to take that into account when I compare it to data, because the noise value that I estimate from one neural response will be bigger than it's uncorrelated value. Okay.
So Daniel, I guess you just read it. I'm sorry, I'm mumbling here. So the way I understood it is the noise, you're actually building it into the threshold.
Yes.
So that's what you're saying is independent in this case.
Yeah. So there is there are multiple ways of thinking about the noise in this problem. One could say that the neuron is noiseless except that its threshold fluctuates. And another way is that the neuron is also noiseless, but the signal fluctuates. And those are equivalent. So let me show you the answer of that to that problem. And so as I said, that here is information. So the more on this axis, the better. The noise is on the this axis. So low noise, high reliability of individual neurons. Low reliability is high noise. So we do not compare. So technically, when we optimize solutions for a given metabolic cost, I only look at this parameter here, which is the threshold difference between neurons. And we will separately consider solutions for different noise because it's different metabolic cost. So in the low reliability regime, when there are individual thresholds are poorly defined, what we find is that the maximum of information has a single peak, and this peak is for the threshold difference between the two neurons at zero. Yes.
I still didn't get it. So how do you choose the absolute threshold? I mean,
so this figure is done for for the absolute threshold that is fixed to some number, and the absolute the sum of the two thresholds is will determine the spike rate for the average spike rate for the two neurons. So all of this figure, you can view it as all of these curves correspond to the same spike rate for the two neurons, and we set it to something that was comparable to the data. I think it's 0.2 for the two neurons. And if that parameter changes, then this basic structure will remain unchanged, but the value along the information value will go up and down, and maybe this bifurcation point that I will talk about in a moment will shift. So the threshold difference, so for low reliability noisy neurons, we find that one should have one class of neurons, and this is the regime of redundant coding. You just have two detectors and you average over them. So the interesting effect is here, because there is some critical value of the noise where it becomes optimal to the maximum of information is observed for a finite difference between thresholds. So you spontaneously, as in physics, we say spontaneously break the symmetry between neurons. You have two identical neurons, and one of them will take over the low dynamic range, and the other one will take high dynamic range. And you break the exchange symmetry between neurons because you don't care which of the neurons will will do which job. So that's the symmetry between these two peaks. Because I can either name neuron 1 for the high threshold case, or neuron 1 for the low threshold case, and that will be the difference in threshold values. Yes.
So, but it's still, I mean, I'm still not very clear about this threshold difference, because, I mean, if you say there's a low range and a high range, I mean, if you want to maximize information, there's the one place where you should put this threshold. So you can be completely off and there wouldn't be any information. If you put the thresholds, the difference, you keep it the same, but you put it really high, you won't detect anything, there wouldn't be any
Well, so you're, where you put them is constrained by the spike rate for the two neurons. And then...
I see, okay.
And then for a given spike rate, so basically there are zero free, ones. If you give me the spike rate and I know the noise value, we know exactly where the threshold should be, and that's how I will compare it with data. Okay, so at the end, there are zero free parameters remain.
This is basically because neurons only spike on threshold crossing.
As opposed to
firing over threshold.
No, it fires all the way above the certain threshold. So, you say, well, this is my probability distribution, and one neuron has this threshold and fires everywhere here, and the other neuron will have this threshold and fire everywhere here.
In a sense, to me, the surprising part of the curve is not the split, but the fact that it's ever analytically, so it's analytically zero difference in threshold, right? It's not just small. The answer
That's
is actually
right.
It's exactly zero. So.
It is, yes. Well, the split, I think, is important because it actually relates to dynamics. It's sort of open-ended and speculative at this point, but in principle, I think it could explain this 1 over f dynamics in neural circuits.
Sure. To me it seems obvious that under low noise conditions you'd want to have two separate thresholds because then they are telling you different things, non-redundant things. So to me it's just the surprise is looking from the opposite end of the diagram that was surprising to you, right? So.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So then...
I have a question. I'm confused enough by your answer to Alex. When you said it fires anywhere above the threshold, does that mean it keeps firing as long as the current is above the threshold?
Well, yes. So.
And how fast does it fire? What's the
relationship? No, I mean we discretize, so it's a discrete model. As long as it is not a perfect model, but it says that for all values of x above a certain threshold, the neuron will fire.
But if it stays above the threshold for a long time, what happens?
In this model, it will still fire. But the hope is that we assume that P of x is a random variable, so it's not going to stay there for a long time.
But I mean, if it did stay above threshold and it did keep firing, you'd have to have a model for how it fired when it was above threshold.
So in principle, so this is simplification. So I'm saying that the neuron is sensitive to one feature. The way I usually get out of that problem is I say that the neuron is sensitive to that feature, and typically they're sensitive to the derivative of that feature. And then they will not fire as long as the neuron stays, as long as the input stays above that value, the derivative will, it only fires, for example, on the positive crossing.
I thought that's what you said in the beginning. I thought you were saying that it only fired when it crossed the threshold going up.
No.
And it didn't fire again until it went over the threshold again.
No, this is a discrete model, so with one feature, but those are the extensions that could consider, but not here.
Okay. Is it fair to say that you can run your model just by the signal is drawn in each time bin from a Gaussian distribution, and then you add a little bit of Gaussian distributed random noise for each neuron on top of that?
That's right.
Okay. All right. So you do that in each time slice. You just draw those three random numbers.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So no correlation.
Continuity essentially.
Right. It's not. There's no actual continuity each time. Right.
Yeah. So the only continuity is when filtering by the time kernel.
Yeah.
Okay. So so now I would like to compare this prediction with data using this argument so that we actually have full control over if you give me the firing rate and the noise levels. So the noise level, how do we measure it in the data, is if I have the firing rate for the neuron as a function of its input value, it has usually some kind of a logistic function, and then the noise value is the spread of this function. So we will measure from data these input-output functions. We know the threshold, we know the noise, and we can compare values that are predicted, extracted from experiments with values that are predicted by theory. So this model was inspired by this observation of two cells.
Can you let me know, so leave the backlights on for you so you can use the blackboard. If it gets too faint.
Yeah, I think it should be okay.
Yeah, they're also videoing it, so I don't know what the contrast is, but let's not worry about
okay.
it.
Okay, so what, so now we have this prediction for the bifurcation, and we also, so the whole model was inspired by the observation that there are two subtypes of off cells in the retina that have the same temporal feature. Their temporal kernels are here. So the features are identical. Their spatial profiles are similar, and these are the different nonlinearities for different contrasts. But for a given contrast, it will be a sigmoidal function, so we can extract the noise and the slope and the threshold value and compare this with experiments.
These are off ganglion cells.
Yeah, so the surprising finding was that previously, usually, the cell types are defined by neurons sensitive to different types of input features. And here, neurons had the same feature, but different thresholds.
I guess what people with those skepticism might have is that you relate subtype with threshold. I mean, there are many examples on cells of the same type, they have a different threshold. But, like vestibulocular reflex, the nuclei that control the eye position, the tanks work. I mean, people before him, they showed that there are millions of neurons in the nuclei, but they have different thresholds. Or does it mean that there are millions of cell types?
Well, maybe. It means how tightly are these thresholds distributed, whether it warrants the distribution of, whether the distribution of thresholds overlaps or not. So in the case of the retina, one can actually check that, because these cell types I'm showing here form separate mosaics and overlapping mosaics. So the reason I think that potentially these different types of cell types are missed in other parts of the brain is because just like you said, well, they have different thresholds, but we don't know whether they form different subtypes or there's just a lot of variability in the threshold.
But there's a continuum.
Or there is a continuum. So that's the question that perhaps, if you put it next to a theoretical framework, you can say, does it look for whether the thresholds cluster into two, for example, Gaussians or not. So in the case of the retina, why they were discovered? Because so I'm showing here the mosaics, and canonically, typically people think that each cell type tiles the visual space, and once they were overlapping, that's an indication that they are separate cell types. And then if you separate these neurons by their nonlinearities, then the mosaics no longer overlap. So they have two separate mesites that are overlapping. So in the retina, it's easier to discover these cell types, but my supposition is that they exist in cortex and elsewhere. It's just that they're more obvious in here. And another point that is not, I'm not mentioning here, but they actually, not only they have different thresholds, but there's also, they have different dynamics of adaptation. What happens when you change contrast? And they are distinguished by one of them. So typically, if you change contrast, the threshold of a neuron goes down. So one of the neurons, the high threshold neuron, goes down. The low threshold neurons goes essentially to zero and then goes back up. So they bracket the minimum together. So there are other ways how one could check whether there are separate cell types, independent of theory. Yes.
In your model of two neurons in your data, with the cost, so if just hypothetically you had a third one, you do position itself in the middle, which up to one or low. That's that kind of.
Yeah, so this one is an interesting question. I will show you some data, but what happens right now, I envision working in the regime of, even though it's just two neurons, it's actually two subpopulations of neurons. So the idea is that you begin with a large subpopulation, and in this mechanism, it splits into two halves. But under some circumstances, if you have it can split into simultaneously into three subpopulations or more. I will show you some data from, it depends on the kind of, there are different types of transitions, and there are different types of splits that one could imagine. I think this is the most ubiquitous one, but then,
because the way that I would understand the two populations, you know, I try to understand how important this specific factor, what you place up front, is the maximization of information for a given metabolic cost versus time in the space, versus adaptation, versus many, many other factors that play a role in separation.
Okay, so tiling is the same part of the same argument. So in reality, you know, this is the theory of two neurons, but I will then argue that this is a phase transition. The phase transition is only occurs for large populations of neurons. So in reality, what happens? Suppose you have an array of neurons, and at each location you have two neurons, and then at some point it becomes optimal, or you have an array of neurons. And they tile. And at some point, you compare this with an array with half the density, but twice the number of neurons. So that's a canonical description of a phase transition in physics, where you have an array, and then, for example, an element can be with equal probability at different types of nodes, but then at some point the probability to be at one node, it's like a binary alloy mixtures, is no longer 50-50, and then alloy separates into two sub
But I don't see these as two 50-50 populations. I think you've got like one neuron that's a super generalizer and one neuron that's quite selective. But for instance, that filter that you've got there is an average of many features. Right, and the
this
low,
one?
Yeah, some kind of average, right, over lots of little features. Like your low threshold neuron has picked out a lot of things, some low, some high, because he's low threshold, he'll fire to a lot of things. And whereas your high threshold neuron fires really selectively to just a few things in that stimulus that are really interesting. So I'm trying to figure out how that's dividing into a 50-50, because it's not really, it's like a 100 to 25 or something like that.
So there are two questions. One of them, it's not, it could be, so there are two points. One of them, in reality, it's not really 50-50, but it's maybe one quarter to 75. And that question I can address in a moment. But what I was wanted to clarify, that this is the temporal feature for that neuron. And the blue and red are the temporal features. So after that, the two neurons make, it just one neuron fires to a low threshold of that feature and the other one to the high threshold of the same feature, but the features are the same. Now, the question of, and I will show you data on the next slide regarding whether it's 50-50 or not. Did I answer your question or?
No, I'm still gathering information, so just keep going, it's fine.
That's the thing. So it's a bit reminiscent of arbitrary nerve fibers.
Exactly.
You get 10 arbitrary nerve fibers, they have different thresholds. All of them are momentously increasing. Yes. The theory for why that should be.
Yeah, I think that's another way of applying this. That in principle, at high noise level, you're supposed to have one kind of auditory nerve fibers, and then you split it into two. And then each of them will split further, and so on. So you will have a hierarchy of cell types. So this is to answer the question about 50-50. So it's not exactly 50-50, but it varies by the time type of the temporal feature that the neurons might have. So they have these are different types of off neurons that pick up different, they have different time courses of features that they present. So they split in different fractions. And the reason to reconcile it with theory is because, you know, I consider solutions for a given metabolic cost. So I say that I weigh the spike of one neuron and the spike of another neuron equally. But in reality, they saturate at different levels. So I might have to adjust how I weight these two neurons separately, and perhaps it could account for this. But what was interesting and the motivation for the comparison between theory and experiment is that in the on channel, so these are off channels, in the on channel, they never split into two different subpopulations. So, and then it turns out that the reason they do not split can be found here is that when we start plotting the low threshold part of the sigmoidal function, the on neuron is the yellow curve. So that's the firing rate as a function of the stimulus filtered by its feature is more shallow than those for the two kinds of off neurons. So we can extract the estimated noise, and the estimated noise for the two types of off neurons is less than the estimated noise for the on neurons. And remember, we were talking about the split between two cell types as a function of noise. So now we can compare where does these two values for that are estimated from the data, where do they fall relative to the critical point.
Tanya, could you tell me what's being plotted on that left graph? Because I don't know what are on the axes.
So on the axis is the average firing rate of the neuron. Huh? And here is the strengths of the stimulus filtered by its feature and how strongly the stimulus resembles its feature.
Is it a GLM model?
It's a GLM model. It's a nonlinear gain function. So basically, zero means that the preferred feature is absent right now. 0.5 means that it has the stimulus resembles somewhat the preferred feature. Minus 0.5 means that the stimulus is opposite of what the neuron is looking for.
But, so how do you actually? Because so this comes from like an LN model, right?
Yes.
So there's an arbitrary, so this is plotting the L value of L.
This is
essentially a plot of N as a function of L, right?
Yes.
So isn't the actual overall magnitude of L essentially arbitrary in the LN model?
Yes.
So how do you plot them on the same axis then? If you just scaled the yellow one by, say you multiplied all those.
That's right. So it's all in units of sigma. It's all in units of sigma of the of the L.
Okay,
because that's how we compare it with data. Everything is in units of sigma. So the input is white noise. It remains white noise. So this is one standard. So one would be a standard deviation of that filtered L signal.
So here you're saying that the estimated level of noise seems to be lower for the off set of responses
right.
compared to the on responses. And in the plot that you did, in which you have two cells,
yes.
at a high level of noise, you want to have only one population, one
yes.
or both cells doing the same. But I was thinking that actually, that plot that you did, you have an extra parameter, which is actually two, that you have two cells. But if you, you know what I'm saying, you start to add three or more actual number of cells, then that plot shape is going to be different, right? So if you start to put three cells or four cells, at some, if you're saying that maybe this is large enough number of cells, the population is going to have the same threshold, and then it's going to
be
the population. But that's two limits, right? Two cells versus a very large number of cells. So there's going to be some sensitivity to that. So I was thinking that I don't think you can make that comparison unless the two numbers of cells, of on cells and off cells, are the same, are they?
Yeah, that's what we, the question is, you have an array of neurons, and the question is, if you have two types of on cells, should you have them have the same threshold or not? So we can compare this with data, and so what happened?
Can you give a little bit of intuition about why it's ever optimal to have them have the exact same threshold? Why is that ever the optimal solution? I mean, it seems like you get an epsilon bit of more information by knowing that they're slightly different from each other, but
at the very least, it should be a flat function or something.
Yeah,
or you think it's a noise station, very noisy, you want to make two measurements in average, and the devices are the same, that's not
enough. And your gain is shallow. When you have large noise, your gain is shallow. So a single curve can span the entire dynamic range of the signal. So why not put both curves?
Yeah, I think that would be it will be perceived as an extra noise.
Whereas small noise, a single curve can't span the dynamic range. So you that means you need one curve to span the low part, another curve to span the high part.
Yeah, I've been struggling. I mean, that's one explanation. I've been struggling to come up with another explanation.
Meaning incorrect.
No, I mean, this is correct.
Not satisfying.
I kind of plot these probabilities, and I see, well, they change their. So I agree that that's. I would like to be able to answer it better.
Sure. Okay.
So
there's the analogous thing that Jasper did for transcription factor binding. Yeah,
I think that is
there,
similar.
Yeah, it's count fluctuations, and you favor to have two identical promoters if you are in the high noise.
That's right. Yeah. So I think that's similar to the Jasper's. Yeah. So
your model needs two neurons, right? I kind of
yes.
understand intuitively that the solution, but in the case of retina, you have now two neurons,
like two arrays,
but two
arrays.
Right. But is that the same? Why not? You know.
Well, in addressing that question, it is to some extent it is the same. I can rely on Vijay's results. Since he came in just recently. But basically, the idea is that if you have an array of neurons or multiple array of neurons, then the information that is provided by two arrays is proportional to the array size times the kind of the unit lattice, of how much information is provided by the unit size of the array. Now, that unit size of the array is, our two neurons. So then you can compare one arrangement versus two different arrangements of units.
But to amplify that a bit more, that's important because the retinal receptor fields tend to remove the long distance correlations
And so what correlations remain in the retinal output tend to be for neurons that are overlapping receptor fields. And that you can directly measure and discount for. And then what Tanya says applies to a way of thinking of encounter.
So then what we can do is we know from the data where were the thresholds. So I know the average value of the thresholds. I know the firing rate, and I can make the average firing rate, and I can, for different cell types, it fluctuates. So we can make a different plot for different average firing rate. So that's the error bar for the critical value. But overall, the average measurements of the noise of two neurons in the off regime are in this regime where it's optimal to split versus the measurement of the noise of the neurons in the on channel is in the regime where it's optimal not to split.
Is this another phenomenon of chronic noise? So for instance, in the limit where noise goes very, very low, I would expect neurons to have a heavy side response. Their condition function would be an open problem.
So I had a small childcare emergency.
There's a question.
I think it was a question, right?
It was
yeah.
A question, yeah. So is this not monotonic? Because the transfer function, if you have your condition transfer function in the low noise limit, I would expect it limit to a heavy side. If the stimulus is above
yeah, so
value.
At some point it is a heavy side function. So in this case here, in the low noise, at some point zero noise means a heavy side function.
So is this going to then, so if you have sort of just two transfer functions, both are heavy side, then I would expect, so in that limit, in the limit of noise going to zero, I would expect the overall information to start going down again. Is that true?
No.
That's not true in this case?
So this is an amazing part. It's not amazing, it is... but the question is that, as you see, that information always increases.
Yeah.
Right? The lower the noise, the higher the information. So in principle, you are supposed to...
You're gonna get like digitization problems, right? Like, there's, yeah. You know, if you put your two heavy sides, there's going to be the tail of the distribution that's below the lower heavy side that never gets transferred. Like probability zero gets transferred, right?
Yeah.
And then the same thing on the upper end.
Exactly. So yeah. Then the question becomes if so I will try to argue. So you know the real data cluster around this point here. It doesn't go to the infinite. Right?
Yeah.
So even though based on the information, it's supposed to go that way, right? So one could say, well, maybe it just doesn't do the metabolic cost. But I think there's another way, and it's related to adaptation, because once you are really that sharp, you cannot sense the changes in the probability distribution.
Right.
So that will be the argument of why you would like to be near this critical point.
I guess I was just saying that eventually, for small noise, you're going to information will go down. So it would make sense to me that you
well,
don't want to.
Well, in this model, it doesn't.
It doesn't. Okay. It doesn't. Okay.
It doesn't. So.
I mean, what if you just have a threshold detector for Gaussian signal? What's the maximum information per?
Well, it depends on the firing rate. So yeah. It's p log p yeah. Minus.
Okay.
That,
sure.
And
so
that's
it. Can actually
it.
Go high, yeah. Right.
So it can go, the maximum is, you know, one half or one bit.
So this is the sum of information for the two neurons together,
yeah,
right? So
that's
so
right.
So this would actually saturate at one, basically. Right?
One or maybe two.
Okay. Yeah, one.
Sure.
So in this case, you're assuming, because it's information, you're assuming that you have a perfect decoder that can actually. That actually knows this cell as the low threshold, this cell is the high threshold. But on the other hand, the other approach of having one population is more robust to decoding errors. Instead of connecting to the low threshold, the threshold, all cells are doing basically the same. So the decoding is very simple. So wouldn't that actually move this curve for, if you add actually some noise in the decoder, it actually moves will move this, that even at the lower levels of knowledge, you still would like to have only one population?
Yeah, I didn't, decoding is left out of this picture.
But in the brain, there is somebody decoding it.
Yeah, there are 100 million
things over here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't just complain about something that somebody's not doing, right? You're going to go with what they're doing.
Yeah, so, you know, the question is, you know, the decoder is limited by how much information is there, and now we can ask how much, you know, the metabolic, I think you're asking what is the metabolic cost associated with different types of decoders.
So.
Right, so that's a valid point that I'm not addressing here.
You need any more science to be done still?
The summary so far is that we see that there is a critical value of noise below which a homogeneous population of neurons splits into two cell types. And we see that in the retina, we could find agreement with no adjustable parameters. And I was intrigued by parallels. At this point, I think they're just suggestive with the second order phase transition, where the noise would be the effective temperature, and the threshold difference between cell types is magnetization, which is a different association from conventional Ising model, where we assess, associate magnetization with a difference between spiking and not spiking in a single neuron. But here we sort of emphasize the relative nature of the a spike in code as it's a threshold difference between cell types. And it actually comes with the broken exchange symmetry, which is one of the features of a phase transition. And in this case, it's this exchange symmetry between neurons. And I will make this more quantitative in a moment, or in a few moments.
So, as you know, I'm very sympathetic to this class of arguments, but let me make two alternate hypotheses, one of which I think relates to the question that was asked before. So here's one alternate. The alternate is that the reason why you split cell types is not necessarily because of noise giving you advantages relative to noise in this way, but because if you evaluate, as you know, there's a law of diminishing returns, right? As in you double the rate, you get less than double the amount of information, so to speak. So if you split up your information channels into things that fire at lower rates, you get more bang for the buck. So it's just straight that you know, you try to distribute the information to many channels because you get, I don't know, more bits per spike or something like that. That's sort of another kind of information theoretic argument you could make for why you develop many parallel channels. Okay, so that's one alternate.
Yeah.
So let me enumerate a third alternate, which is, I think, the default assumption that we often make in neurobiology, that the spectrum of cell types is not determined by this kind of peripheral information theoretic consideration, but rather by the kinds of features that are useful for later decoding and for reconstructing behavior. That really, you know, your visual repertoire. Why do you have edge detectors? Well, you're a baby, you know, you need to avoid falling off the edge, you know, that kind of thing. And so
I will begin with the second question. One is, question is, what should be the feature? And usually the cell type is defined by what is the feature. So that's a parallel argument. Given that we are interested in that feature, and we can argue how much metabolic cost I should allocate to that feature, and that's the question between off and on. For example, why more off than on? But given that I have allocated certain metabolic cost to encoding this same feature, should I do it with similar thresholds or different thresholds? So I view the overall theory of cell types first is the question, what are the features? If you encode multiple features, should you do it with separate thresholds or not? I have a slide that I think it might be easier for me to draw than to pull it up from the back. But the question is, if you have a correlated Gaussian distribution, one hypothesis is that you do decorrelation by encoding different types of features. But then at some point, the if they're so correlated, then maybe the variance in the lower feature is comparable to the neural noise, and then you might be better off switching to encoding the more informative feature and cutting that in, and that you can do with two neurons, but then when you do it with two neurons, you do it with same threshold or different thresholds.
Okay, so I have a further follow-up question, if that's okay this time. And that's the following. Okay, so suppose I accept that, but if I think about the spectrum of cell types in the retina, which is a prime example for these things, you know, there's color opponent cells, the yes. direction selective cells, and then there are basically two species of on and off detectors, the fast ones and the slow ones, which is what you're talking about. So this appearance of two populations with different thresholds occurs just for the on and off cells, and not, for example, for the direction selective cells.
But just for the off cells.
Just
for the off cells.
Right.
And not for the and not for the direction selective cells.
Right.
So why would it be that there's just this one feature for which this consideration
becomes relevant? Well, so you know, the question of different features is somewhat not addressed, but I would argue that you know there's a separate question of how much metabolic cost I should allocate to the feature. Then. My hypothesis would be that if you measure the nonlinear gain function of directional selective cells, then they would be in this regime and not in that regime. And then one could test that. So this was a second order phase transition, meaning that we have two neurons that one maximum splits into two maxima. But actually, so this is one example that from prior work using different measures, but this is from the auditory system. This is a pure theory work, which says you begin with a population where you have the same set of thresholds, and then you split them into subpopulations. And then, as in this case, they use the not the noise, but how many, what's the time window in which you count spikes. And one can view this as kind of increasing amount of reliability as a kind of counting window increases. So you can have this hierarchy of transition. And this is from the auditory work encoding different time. This is the width of the tuning curves, and this is interval oral time differences. So if it is a broadly tuned, you get one set of values quantized. If it is more or less broadly, and then it's numerical work, so it's a little bit puzzling. I don't quite understand why it goes between 2 and 3 and back to 2, but maybe I sort of ascribed it to the numerical simulations.
If it's an artifact of numerical simulations, that's not good.
No, I mean, I don't know, the transitions, so I believe that there is a discretization, and that maybe addresses your question, but it's a different, it's a numerically difficult problem to optimize.
Is it going 2 to 3? The 2 is going 2 to 3.
It's going 2 to 3. I mean, that's
what's
where with numerics. Yeah, with numerics, it's hard to say. I think it was like 50 neurons, Fisher information. Not so. There are many differences. This is not a binary neuron. This is you know, it's like similar except that it's a Fisher information, not mutual information, and non-binary neuron versus binary neuron, and but
maybe
I think
it's in nature.
Huh?
It's just
true.
I mean,
okay.
It's just the nature.
Yeah.
So then I wanted to follow up and add another twist to this story, meaning that in reality, the from biological reality, the high threshold cells have different noise values than the low threshold cells. So I sort of treated them that they all have the same thresholds, and we obtain the split. But this goes back to this question of whether it's optimal to have exactly zero split. And if you have exactly the same noise level in the neurons, then yes, they are exactly, supposedly exactly will overlap with the threshold. But in reality, it turns out that the normalized thresholds are different across different contrasts between these high threshold and low threshold cells. But also the estimated noise levels are also different between low threshold and high threshold. So intuitively, it should make sense that if I have a threshold device that I put closer to the mean, it should be more reliable. So the neuron that has a lower noise should go towards the middle of the distribution. And the neuron that has a high noise, high threshold, should have a high threshold, it can be outside of the distribution. So that's one qualitative explanation. And that's the same model, but now we will have two detectors with two different noise levels. And that's how the picture is modified. So the noise is on this axis here, but this is the average noise between neurons. And now one of them has higher noise than the other. So now the symmetry between them is broken, such that there is one maximum is bigger than the other. And the threshold difference is actually not exactly at zero. And one can plot the slope difference, the optimal threshold difference, as a function of the slope difference. And when the slope difference is zero, these were our previous results, then the curves, the threshold difference is zero, and then it abruptly jumps to some value, and then that increases. But then when the slope difference is not zero, then it automatically induces the finite difference between the thresholds. And it agrees with the data qualitatively here, meaning that if the slope difference is positive, so we are in this quadrant, so basically there is no solutions in the opposite quadrants. Either positive slope differences goes with positive threshold differences, or negative slope differences go with negative slope differences. So in the data we see that the threshold red type is greater than the blue type, and the noise is red is greater than blue, meaning that they're always in this quadrant.
I'm sorry, I think I was daydreaming here. So the different points here is a different contrast level, and the blue and the red are averages of multiple of what are considered one cell type versus the other, right?
Yes, right. So the neurons are probed with multiple contrast, and this is across multiple measurements in multiple retinas, multiple preparations.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if I should, are you saying that the left curve predicts the fact that the new actually changes dramatically, the differences when you change the
contrast? It doesn't exactly, I will show you a comparison on a neuron by neuron basis, but right now it just says that the positive difference between these and goes with positive difference.
Yeah, but you're not explaining that there's this weird divergence.
Yeah, here. I'm not yet explaining, and I don't know if I don't think I will explain it. So then, what was encouraging to me, and this is a little segue into physics, but these curves are actually reminiscent of the first order. So there's a second order transition, but the first order transition is of this kind. If you have two maxima and one of them is higher than the other, and then they switch abruptly, so that's the first order phase transition.
Most perfect comments.
Some talks I wish I could do that.
Sorry, I had my husband had to drive to San Diego on a short notice,
totally
so
fine.
And he had a childcare emergency. So we had So what is interesting is that there is this, the goal is to potentially identify what are the corresponding quantities between this type of phase transition and the phase transition in physical systems. So this suggests that the magnetic field, which induces difference between two different magnetizations, is the slope difference that induces the threshold difference. So this would be the analogous quantities. And then I'm coming back to this question of comparing single neurons. So what is shown here is that we take two pairs of neurons that were recorded, we find their average thresholds, and we compute their slope differences. We also extract it from the data, and then we plot the firing, the information as a function of the remaining force parameter. So the slopes, the two noise levels for two neurons are extracted from the data, and the average threshold is also extracted from the data. And then the remaining parameter is the threshold difference between neurons. This is relative information. That's the information curve that they could have. And the real threshold difference falls near the maximum of this curve. And if I compare across the same pair as a function of different contrasts, you see that the curves are just off, for clarity, are shifted relative to each other, but often the real data is close to this peak. What is also interesting is that, especially at low contrast, there's this other peak that appears, and the neuron follows this, the first peak. And that's actually, I think, is a real phenomenon. And I think it's related to the fact that we are talking about first order phase transition, and you have a hysteresis in the data. That's. But overall, if you measure what is the information provided by the real data points compared to the maximum data points, on average it's 97%. And then the trick is to account for this. Why is it not 100%, which I will address.
Okay. You sound like my dad. 97% wasn't quite close enough.
Yeah. Yes, but you know, there's this joke that if you did 90% of the work in 10% of the time, then the remaining 10% will take 90% of the time. So this, that's what we are spending most of our time right now, is explaining this remaining 3%. And I think it is an important 3% because it relates to the question of adaptation.
Just to make sure that I understand correctly, what in this is pure theory and what of this is experimental match?
So this one, these are theoretical curves.
Yeah.
These are theoretical curves that have, so the theoretical curves depend on four parameters. And we can compute theoretical curves as a function of three parameters that were extracted from the data.
Okay.
So it's a theory of where three parameters of the curve, three parameters are extracted from the experiment, and the remaining parameter is compared with the data. Right.
Okay.
Is that,
I think I understand. So and then the, what you're comparing, when you say it's 97%, it's 97% given the sort of global optimum over all four.
Yeah, so this one, this versus that.
Okay.
So taking all the noise values from the data and the average threshold from the data, mm-hmm. we predict what's the maximum and what's the true maximum. So that's a comparison between this and a black dot and the maximum of the theoretical curves.
Okay.
It's the maximum of all the theoretical curves, right? Because for some of them, the dot is the maximum.
Yes, and for
but
some of
this
them,
never reaches one, so you're using the very highest one, maybe the
that's recurrence. Right.
Maybe.
So this one versus
yeah.
that. So then, if I'm allowed, I will make a little digression because it's maybe potentially relevant to the dynamics in neural circuits. But so far, I have described that mutual information behaves as a function of the threshold difference and the noise and the slope difference. And near this critical point, it can be summarized in this simple expansion. When we say that information as a function of threshold difference is a symmetric function whose first order term changes sign as a function of noise, and I can tilt this function by introducing slope difference. So all of the theoretical results up to this point can be summarized by this simple expansion.
Is threshold difference your small parameter? Is that the
The threshold difference is, so it, near that critical point, it is a small parameter.
Absolutely, yeah, sure.
So we are saying what is behavior near that critical point, and all of these various behavior can be summarized by this simple equation. It is a maximum that becomes a minimum, two other maximum appear, and they tilt.
Yeah, it's just so m is a small parameter, that's all.
Yes, yeah. M is a small parameter, and then, of course, that's a Landau theory of phase transitions. So once I have this expansion, I can predict all kinds of scaling relationships. For example, how would the optimal threshold difference M vary as a function of noise? And it should vary as a square root. And it does. And in numerical simulations, you can check by plotting the logarithm of threshold difference as a logarithm of the noise difference relative to its critical point, and it's a beautiful power law. One could check that the threshold difference as a function of the slope difference will behave, theory predicts, as 1/3 power, and this is what simulations also say. Then one could say that the derivative of this function with respect to h, which some say susceptibility of the system as a function of nu, will diverge as 1 over nu, and it does. And then, but all of these relationships, they all follow from the fact that we have this expansion. It's just checking this expansion. And then the analogous quantity to specific heat, which will be the second derivative of information with respect to nu, will have a jump here.
Yes. Sorry, but for off cells, original cells, shouldn't you find some trace of the bidimensional structure of the original?
Which one? Which structure? I didn't get. D-dimensional?
The bidimensional structure, bidimensional structure, two-dimensional structure.
Yes. I'm getting there in three slides, I think. So
right now there's still no space in this model at all.
So I will talk about d-dimensional structure is coming. So because so far this is Landau theory of phase transitions. It's a mean field theory. It has no dimensionality. Dimensionality appears when we start comparing with the data, and in the preview of the results we will find that it is a three-dimensional. It's not two-dimensional, but then I can fold the three-dimensional into a two-dimensional structure by accounting by a certain power law correlations decay. So that's a preview of three slides forward. Yes?
So I think I missed a couple of points, so I just ask for clarification. So I is mutual information computed between a distribution of dark spots of some kind in the world. Yeah.
Off features.
And the output of two species of neurons with different thresholds.
Different or the same threshold?
Oh, yeah. So M is a threshold difference. Yeah, M is a threshold difference. But their bandwidth is the same, as in their peak firing rates are the same. And the noise for both is the same, but it's variable. You may decide how much noise there is in the system.
So noise is a parameter.
But it's the same for both cell types.
Not necessarily, because the slope difference is the difference between noise between the two cell types.
Okay. And what's assumed about the distribution of off features?
So for the distribution of off features, You don't have to assume very much, but what we checked is that if you say that the distribution of off features is either a Gaussian distribution or a Laplacian distribution, then this basic structure will remain, but the critical point here will change. And the scaling, so you know, you have all of these parameters that are non-universal, A, nu C, B, and C, they depend on the structure of the probability distribution.
Okay. I guess the reason I'm asking is, of course, in this kind of theory, it's always universality classes.
Yes.
And you're going to wind up saying something about the universality class in which the system's actually sitting.
Yes.
But the real system. But then that's going to depend on various assumptions, this, that, and the other, about, let's say, the distribution of dark features, you know, something.
No, I don't think it, because I think that the answer for different distributions will be that the different distributions are in the same universality class. So which, I mean, I cannot make a general argument, but we compared the Gaussian distribution and a Laplace distribution, and they were in the same class. I mean, ultimately, you know, what happens is if you change the tails of the distribution, then the basic features are not going to change. What will matter is exactly where the threshold will sit, and a thing like that.
I'm sorry, maybe I also missed something. So the graphs showing the black dots are simulation points. What's shown on the graph, actually?
So on the graph is, so this is, right now this is a simulation.
And it's simulation.
These are all simulations and analysis of optimal theory numerically.
So
and
the
then
blue, the green line is the theory.
Is it fit to the
simulation?
Theory.
Okay.
Yes.
And simulation, what you explained at the beginning, two neurons. And,
yes.
Okay.
So
yes.
The data is coming when we will.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I can think about this as two linear nonlinear neurons responding to some distribution of inputs.
Yes.
And with different thresholds, basically different nonlinearities that have been put there.
Yes.
And then you evaluate the total mutual information with the output of this these two neurons and this world.
Yes.
So, okay. Great. And that's.
So so now comparison, another way of comparing with data. And here I have to bring neurons to the same, different types of pairs of neurons to the same world, meaning that, you know, if I plot the threshold difference between neurons in the theory as a function of noise, these curves depend on the average firing rate. So we're going to rescale. And in this case, different neurons will be able to plot on the same graph in normalized units. So that's what's done here. Each dot here is a neuron pair. This is average noise for the two neurons. And this is a normalized threshold difference to account for the fact that each pair of the neurons will have different firing rates, and therefore, kind of the different scaling on this axis. But that's the optimal theory for one value, and they're rescaled such that they're on the same value. So now we can fit this curve. So this is now data. And we can fit this curve as a function of nu. And the theory predicts a square root. We get a slightly different answer. So in this case, it is instead of 0.5, it's 0.39 plus minus 0.12. And the other exponent is with respect to the difference in the noise is it's supposed to be 3 in the theory and the mean field theory. And here we have 7 plus minus 4. Yes?
Could you comment a little bit? There seem to be two curves there.
Huh?
There seem to be two, the actual data points.
Yeah, I've been staring at them. I don't know. So far, maybe there's something there, but it does look like it. But
this is extrapolation. I mean, don't get me wrong, but if I want to determine the power law, I want to see kind of one or two orders of magnitudes.
No. The issue is I'm not so yes and no. So if you have so that's where the limitation some of the limitations arise, but you know, for example here you have threshold difference versus nu, and this is where our data point will lie. And here, when we plot log of this, you can have many orders of magnitude because you can come infinitely close to this point. Now, I cannot, you know, in physics, we can control the temperature, we can control the noise to tune it to here. I cannot do it here because the data points fall where they fall. So one doesn't, so the theory has, we can check the theory, the scaling exponents, we fit them and we hope for the best. That's, you know, the error bars, that's why one could say that this is a large error bar. And, you know, in experiment in physics, which have a much slower error bar than what we have. But, okay, so this is what, you know, I'm not going to do, you know, this is just the measurement. Yes, it would be greater to have it closer to this point, but they're not here. Okay, so this is shows the measurements in the retina that were fitted. You know, you don't have to, we can fit it, it's just that the, I'm not going to say that the scaling or the presence of scaling or absence of scaling, you would like to have multiple orders of magnitude. But if I say, if I have a scaling, what would be the scaling exponent? Okay, so that's the scaling exponent. So these are the results from theoretical simulations from physical systems to the Ising model. Doesn't really agree with this value. 3D Ising model is consistent with this value. The 4D Ising model, or the mean field, is not is borderline consistent, and the experiment in physical systems also deviate. I took it from the three-dimensional Ising model; they deviate from this from these values. Okay, so you know, taken with a grain of salt, that you know we have limit, we have large error bars here. But we do have a match between the retina, 3D Ising model, and experiments in physics. So at least experiments in the physics deviate from the mean field theory in the same direction as the retina deviates from the predictions in the mean field theory. So then with that caveat that, you know, the exponents, we have large error bars on the exponents, but one could say the scaling exponents in the retina match the 3D Ising model, meaning that interaction between 3D lattices. But then there is this question of what to do with it because the retina is two-dimensional. And so then we looked up, there was a paper by Angelini Parisi and Ricci Tersenghi last year, where they said that if I have interaction between arrays in three dimensions between nearest neighbors, and all of these results are between nearest neighbors, that's equivalent to a low dimension interactions in low dimensional arrays, but with a longer range of correlations. And one can make a specific prediction for the range of these correlations. So if we believe in these exponents, then that makes a prediction that the correlations in the retina decay with that exponent. But arguably, one would like to have a smaller error bar. Okay. So in the last few minutes, I will like to talk about the fact that the why information is not, why the data on, you know, technically speaking, the smaller the noise, the greater the information. So the, in principle, all of the data points should be in this regime, kind of going for noise equal zero or negative value on this curve, because nu is subtracted from nu c. Yet the data clusters near the critical point, and there are, you know, other suggestions from other work that the retina is positioned near the critical point. So the question is, if the information is maximized in this regime, then why are the data points in this regime? And I would argue that it has something to do with adaptation.
and measuring being able to change detect changes. So you have information is a function of the threshold difference between neurons, and that's our curve here. But there are two special points that are called spinodal points where the information changes sign, the second derivative changes sign. And that would be a true maximum. That's a true minimum. And information from here to the points from here to there correspond to unstable dynamics, and the points from here to there correspond to metastable dynamics. In other words of saying this, that the information gain to go from here to there is incremental, and from here to this point is faster. So what we see is so the gray line here is the spinodal lines as a function of mu. So what we see that most of the data points are in the regime between corresponding to metastable states. The idea being that the dynamics from here to this line is fast, and from here to there is slow. And if I had only to encode distributions of a given variance, then I would be here. But because the variance, the contrast is changing, and I need to encode multiple different contrasts, perhaps it's not worthwhile for the neurons to capture, to strive for optimal information maximization in a given set of conditions as opposed to under a broad set of conditions.
Maybe I'm confused. What? I mean, we jumped into putting dynamics on this. Is this just an analogy, or is there a formal dynamical system you're talking about where you can define the concepts of stability, or what?
No, this is a different stability. So the stability and metastability is defined. So it was suggested based on analogy. So basically I think there is a way to make this analogy valid. So the point is that if I have an array and you have a fluctuation that preserves the average threshold. So this one is threshold difference between neuron pairs, averaged across the array. Okay. So if I have two pairs that have the same average threshold difference, but one is a little bit on one side and the other one on the other side, when the curve is concave, then when you split them a little bit, the two of them will have more information than the average. When they are on this side, the average of these, and you are here and you split them a little bit, then the average information by the two pairs is slow, is less. So meaning that you have to move all the pairs together. They can't move independently from each other.
Okay, so then you're talking about like a potential landscape? Is that the way you want to think of this?
Yeah,
like
I would say that, information
is... You're looking for minimums, which
right.
is maximums of information.
Yeah, so information is my potential.
Right, so you're not sure if there's this... So you have some kind of gradient and a potential, and then from there,
yeah,
if you want to define a dynamical system, you can.
That's right.
But who cares? You've got a gradient, you go to the bottom, which is really the maximum for information.
Yeah, so the idea is that you have information, this is your potential landscape, and where are the threshold differences are the optimization parameters.
Okay. Yeah. I'm confused. Usually M here, this kind of magnetization, should be an average property of a population.
Yes.
And you have only two types of neurons, which are
yes.
plus or minus one, so M is this average value. But here you're talking about continuous types of neurons?
No, I'm thinking that I have an
yes.
array, and I compute M in different parts of the array.
And
so that's the fluctuation.
Each dot is a separate essentially like nearby pair of neurons? Is that the
So the left graph and the right graph are have different arguments. So here each dot is a separate pair of neurons computed measured simultaneously. So that's data. And when we
each
talk,
each neuron is usually in one of those circles. Is that right?
Yeah.
And the distance between the neurons is small, or?
Well, they're recorded together, these overlapping receptive fields. Yeah, I think this is not a large array. They are, I think they are.
60 electrodes.
Yeah.
What would it matter, though, I think?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean, what does it matter?
Yeah.
Some pairs of neurons, I'm sorry.
Right. But it does, because overlapping ones are correlated and the distant ones are.
Well, yes, it matters a little bit, but I have to say this is a whole field simulation, whole field simulation, so.
Oh, it's even whole field simulation, okay, so they're fine.
Just neurons are translationally invariant. If you measure here, it's just any.
I was more concerned about whether one point was being used to generate multiple of those searches.
I think in reality it does matter because what I think there are the open question here is how does the neurons correlate their threshold? Is one is changing and the other is changing, and perhaps that correlation is done locally. So. Right. Okay.
I mean, can you argue that these curves fit the data better than just a straight line at the mean of the height, for example? Or I mean, I guess that's a not that I have a theory for generating that, but just perhaps the
circle fits, ellipse fits very well.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's all I could say. You know, this would be the optimal curve. This is. Unstable spinodal curve, they lie here in between. That's all. okay.
You know, the data would probably look very different if it was not full field flicker, because the noise properties differ a lot between full field stimulation and naturalistic stimulation. So it could be, all I know, to lie on top of the curve, right? Just say. But what's the species?
This is the salamander. But I think they also did it in a rat.
Is this in Bacchus?
Yes.
Salamander, maybe not.
Yeah. So I think that's the summary. I'm hoping that one could have application of this theory to olfaction. Maybe there are multiple cell types here, but this is my theory slide that I was excited about as a unified framework of neuron physical systems. What I was excited about is that we could identify magnetization as a threshold difference across neurons, which I think emphasizes the relative nature of the neural code. So I think that's all I had to say. Thank you.
That's great. As long as you're not fatigued, I think people can certainly ask questions. Mm-hmm. You can do it formally now or you can do it informally. I think at some point the person who's manning that video room will probably want to shut it off. So I don't want to discourage it just because it sounds like there's a lot of people are interested in, so we should keep asking until you fall down or something. But also just before we move on, so I think normally we have two talks all together, but we couldn't get this room, there was some confusion, so we're going to do the talk at 2. It's all in the wiki schedule, so I might get 2 for 2 minutes.
So, and then, as I said, this is the work was done with David and Steve Bacchus, and two of my students, John Berkowitz and Mandy Su, are helping us to figure out the adaptation part and why it's 97% and not 100%.
Stanya, I was worried about, I'm trying to figure out how you could use a more realistic spike generation model or spike generation description. Would that really change anything, or is it possible to do it?
You're worried about the fact that it stays constant?
Yes, because normally what you do is you normally have some sort of integrated fire model for neurons like this. And it seems like that ought to be someplace in the framework.
Well, I guess what I could say is that sometimes people model integrated fire neurons as multi-dimensional LN type systems. Is that correct? Or?
But I thought that Nick Martinez, Betkin, and Sauger talked about the fact that if you wanted to introduce multiple,
features.
He didn't do including the fact, but I was just thinking that if you want multiple spikes per bin, you can just use a Poisson model for counts.
Yeah, we could do Poisson model for counts.
But that's
I think this one.
Poisson model usually isn't right.
It's not right, right?
Yeah, it's used because it's convenient, but it's not usually the way the data go. And retinal ganglion cells, I don't think the Poisson model.
I would agree that if Poisson model is not valid, the first place it wouldn't be valid is in the retina.
Chuck, is it you want basically some sort of a reset, right? You don't want it to keep
The neurons don't just respond as a threshold crossing, but there are processes that go on to determine the time that spikes occur, not just threshold crossings.
Yeah, but wouldn't the variance, that she's got the variance around the threshold, kind of handles some of that, right?
No, I
know it's like channel activation.
I think the neuron
no
she was talking about
dependent
only on time.
Yes.
And one variable, and I think that's not right. I mean, I think there's a temporal evolution of the spike generation, and I have no intuition about whether the same kind of argument could be made if you took that into account or not.
I mean, Michael Berry said that you can reconstruct most of the information that single neurons capture about visual stimulus from a model which is essentially discretizes time, but allows you to, they tested several of them. The 1-0 model just didn't fire in the time bit or not isn't a bad model, but you can get most of the information the retina encodes if you allow essentially just times and the number of spikes per bin. So essentially, like if you just simply allow it there to be more than one spike in a bin, that the detailed timing within a burst of spikes didn't add very much information at all about the stimulus, and that it was really just if you essentially tagged each event by when the first spike occurred and the number of spikes in the burst, that you reconstructed most of the information about the stimulus.
The world is changing continuously.
Yeah.
And a model like that, I don't think takes the dynamics of how the world is changing into account. If you put a constant light on for a certain length of time, then you could probably do that.
No. This was a very dynamic stimulus. So the biophysical picture, I think, was basically that the number of spikes in the burst essentially was. So neurons fire a burst of spikes when you kick them, and the number of spikes in the burst is a reflection of how hard you kicked them. But once you kick them hard enough, they don't pay much attention to what happens in the next, 50 milliseconds, basically, because they've already decided that they're going to fire a bunch of spikes, basically, at least by sort of heuristic interpretation.
Guys, I think Fred has maybe another
time. So you say timing of the first spike and how big is the burst.
Right.
So a lot of information is in the time.
Yep.
So what Chuck is saying is that time
is a continuous
by generator and
yes.
Dynamics that
yep.
and that's certainly much more complicated than
yep.
a simple threshold.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether that so all of that goes into your feature
Yeah, it could. I'm just not seeing how it happens, and I'm just asking.
What happens is that one way to ameliorate these issues is the temporal kernel itself,
yeah.
because the temporal kernel, to the first approximation, decorrelates the input.
I'm sorry, say again.
So we have a continuous correlated input.
Yeah.
So the feature decorrelates that input.
It's half easy, but it's derivatives, so.
So, I mean, to the first approximation, you know, the input is slowly changing. You put it through a biphasic kernel, and it's not as correlated as it was. So after that, the inputs are more independent.
Anyway, I just was trying to ask you for an intuition about why it would be okay not to worry about the actual spike generating mechanism. But it's too complicated.
If I had to address that directly, I would go into the model with two temporal features, because one would be the relevant feature and the other one would be the derivative, and the neuron would only spike on the positive threshold crossing. So once I have the feature and the derivative, I can ameliorate most of these things. So instead of considering P of X, I need to consider a two-dimensional probability distribution. P of X and X dot.
Maybe my question really has to do with more about the idea that feature detection is everything. You can describe all neurons as detecting a feature you can make, which you know what it is, and they only respond to that. That you know, that's not necessarily true. That's my idea.
Yeah. That's a framework for
business. Yes, it is a framework.
For feature and, you know, if this is the feature, this is the threshold. What are the threshold? Now it could be that, there are deviations from that framework. Yeah.
Right. I think we should probably, unless there are other questions, we should disperse and we can bug Tanya. Maybe after she rests a bit.